It has taken nearly two decades, but the Southeast Alaska economy is now in a cycle of growth and is stronger than ever.
Good news for the residents of Southeast Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, following a bad walrus harvest, a campaign to help the residents of St. Lawrence Island.
Children and elders are hungry. Their freezers are empty.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Southeast Alaska has more residents and more jobs than ever. That's according to a report released today during the Southeast Conference's annual meeting in Sitka. Melanie Shivens of Juneau-based Scheinberg Associates assembled the report called Southeast Alaska by the Numbers. She says Southeast has finally come back from the 1990s timber industry crash. It's also largely recovered from the more recent global economic recession.
Nearly every single economic indicator in the region is up and continuing to rise. It has taken nearly two decades, but the Southeast Alaska economy is now in a cycle of growth and is stronger than ever.
The report says the region added 2,800 residents from 2010 to 2012, the period studied. The total population hit almost 75,000, topping the previous record set a decade and a half ago. Shivan says Juneau grew the most. Ketchikan, Sitka, and Haines attracted many of the other new residents.
The largest group moving here are the 20-somethings. This group is particularly having trouble in the lower 48 job market. They move here for jobs in the summer in the visitor industry, and they stay because they have no jobs to go back to.
She says Southeast's payroll topped $2 billion for the first time in 2010. In 2012, a 10% increase over 2 years. Those wages went to 46,000 people, which is also a record.
Leading the way were gains in mining, professional and business services, the visitor industry, construction, and the Coast Guard.
The report projects the tourism, mining, and healthcare industries will continue to grow in future years. It says the seafood sector will remain about the same. Government and timber will shrink. The major remaining partner in the proposed Pebble Mine said yesterday that so much has already been spent on the project that it could get by with a much smaller budget next year. At a teleconference in London yesterday, Northern Dynasty CEO Ron Thiessen was unwilling to say exactly how much the company would have to shell out to keep moving forward with the permitting process, but he laid out a range.
We've looked at budgets through the permitting process anywhere from, you know, $20 million a year to, I'll say, you know, $40 or $45 million a year. And that predominantly relates to, you know, how big a public affairs campaign one wants to conduct.
He said Northern Dynasty would spend less on public affairs than Anglo American did. In all, Anglo has put an estimated $540 million into Pebble. That included a lot of work on the long-expected project description, which Thiessen said is nearly finished now.
We are 99% complete on, I would say, the project description, which is the functional document for permitting purposes.
Northern Dynasty's other partner, Rio Tinto Mining, holds a 9% share of Northern Dynasty. With the departure of Anglo American, Rio's share in Pebble doubles. But at a shareholder conference yesterday in London, Rio CEO San Walsh said his company has no interest in expanding that share unless Pebble is an underground, not an open pit mine. Thiessen said the search for another major partner will continue.
We will keep the limited partnership in place for the certainly the near future, in the event that another party might see fit to join the structure.
There is no word yet on when the project description will to start the permitting process will be ready. Thiessen said the plan is for Anglo-Americans experts to be replaced by technical staff from Northern Dynasty's parent company, Hunter Dickinson Incorporated, and they will want to take a fresh look at that plan.
The costs involved of going through permitting will drop substantially. There's probably even a difference in the cost of permitting, whether it's done under an Anglo regime or a Northern Dynasty regime, and certainly we'll be looking at that. You know, once we've got that hand, once we've dealt with Anglo's withdrawal, we will look at, you know, what is the most optimum way of moving this project ahead.
Thiessen added that their business model has always been for Pebble to be developed by a consortium rather than one major mining company. Although Northern Dynasty officials say the company will continue to develop plans for the mine in southwest Alaska, APRN's Peter Granitz reports Alaska senators are skeptical.
Senator Mark Begich says Anglo's move is a blow to the would-be mine.
I don't think it dooms. I think it makes it... I don't know what it does. It's a good question. I think it does put some risk on the project because it takes a lot of money.
The Alaska Congressional Delegation has long urged the EPA to allow the partnership to proceed to the permitting process. The EPA could nix the mine outright because of threats to the region's salmon habitat. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Anglo-American's decision reflects a trend in the mining industry. She says International Tower Hill Mines, the operator of the Live and Good Gold project north of Fairbanks, is downsizing the project considerably.
And not because of anything other than business judgment decision based on the price of gold. So it's something that I looked at the announcement and said, well, is it surprising? Quite possibly not.
The price of gold is about $1,300 an ounce, several hundred dollars below what it was a couple of years ago. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The state of Alaska is asking ConocoPhillips to reopen its liquefied natural gas plant on the Kenai Peninsula. Acting Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash, in a letter to ConocoPhillips President Trond Erik Johansen, asked that the company apply for a 3-year license to export LNG from the plant. ConocoPhillips announced in March it would not seek an extension of its export license, but might if local gas market needs were met and there was enough gas to export. Balash says current contracts can support local utility demands through 2018, but petroleum companies lack incentives to explore or invest without more market opportunities for gas. ConocoPhillips spokeswoman Natalie Lohman says the company is evaluating the request. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 5,000 miles in a canoe.
Many of the Alaskans that I talked to before the trip were the most critical of my trip. A lot of them said it wasn't possible. Well, they knew what I was up against.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
While Governor Parnell did declare an economic disaster for the communities on St. Lawrence Island due to a record low walrus harvest this spring, no immediate relief is available from state resources for struggling families. Unlike natural disasters, there is no pot of money available to assist in an economic disaster. And because of this, an organization is spearheading a fundraising effort for the two communities. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
With an economic disaster, the state of Alaska can only do the best they can with existing state money. As of today, no real aid from the state has been given, although Governor Parnell did say in his declaration that the state would work closely with communities to ensure residents of St. Lawrence Island receive the assistance they need. And today, leaders in the communities of Savunga and Gamble are still wondering what aid from the state is planned or not planned. The only tangible relief has come from the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, the regional CDQ. They donated 1,800 pounds of chum salmon for families to distribute, and families are hungry. Vi Wally with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics is looking to raise at least $35,000 to assist families hit by the real but very unique economic disaster. Wally, originally from Savunga, has been in contact with leadership in both communities.
Children and elders are hungry. Their freezers are empty. We had success as far as bowhead whale. However, those are now depleted.
Hunters in Gamble and Savunga typically harvest more than 1,000 walruses every year. This spring, the island was locked in by ice, which prevented hunters from reaching their customary hunting waters in the Bering Sea. Only 370 walruses were harvested, and for communities with a subsistence economy, the low harvest has had a serious impact. Walrus is the main staple on the island, so there's less food and less money coming in. The 2,000 tusks typically harvested bring in a lot of cash, and this has Myron Kingikuk, the mayor of Savunga, worried.
Hopefully this winter won't be very cold, you know, due to not harvesting a walrus that much for the carvers. That's the only thing I'm worried about. Hopefully, State of Alaska will give the whole community energy program for fuel for this winter.
But that would take time. Glenn Haight with the Alaska Division of Economic Development says the legislature may appropriate money for assistance grants, and the legislative session doesn't begin until January. The governor at this point can recommend that capital projects planned for the island be put on the fast track, but the construction season is ending, with temperatures now hitting in the 20s and 30s and winter around the corner. So Vi Wally with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics is getting to work. She set up a PayPal account on their website for individuals to make donations. Wally says ACAT is involved because the low walrus harvest is an environmental justice issue.
Because of changes we're seeing in our environment, whether it's this shrinking sea ice or permafrost melting, it's very real, the changes we're seeing.
And a change is the prevalent southwest winds in the Bering Sea this spring that kept the island locked in ice. Gloria James with the Native Village of Gamble says every year, strong north winds push the ice out in the springtime. The elders used to warn the people of St. Lawrence Island about the potential impact of a southerly wind. And a southerly wind hit this year, and the impact is being felt today with a food and income shortage. Wally and many on the island attribute the change in the wind patterns to climate change.
And this has greatly affected a way of life that our people have lived for many, many generations, living off the land and ocean like our ancestors and grandparents and those before us have lived. So as Alaskans, we need to get together and find ways to help our people.
ACAT hopes to raise $35,000 by December 1st. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Two school bond propositions go before Fairbanks borough voters in the October 1st municipal election. KYC's Dan Bross reports.
The bigger of the two bond packages, Proposition 1 is for $37.1 million to replace Ryan Middle School in Fairbanks. Retired North Star Borough School District maintenance supervisor Dave Faree is co-chairing a committee pushing for the bond's approval. Faree says Ryan is aged out and cheaper to replace.
The engineering report came up with a $9 million savings to replace it rather than to renovate it.
Faree says mechanical and electrical systems are starting to fail and something needs to be done. A new school will vastly improve energy efficiency. Faree is co-chairing the Yes on School Bonds Committee with former school board president Leslie Hajdukovic. Hajdukovic says the district has tried the only other viable means of funding Ryan replacement.
Getting it on the capital improvement list, the state capital improvement list, and it just has never been able to get a high enough ranking to be funded fully by the state.
Hajdukovic stresses that if voters approve the bonds for Ryan, the state will reimburse 60% of the cost. The annual impact on a taxpayer equates to about $27 a year on a $200,000 property. Bond Proposition 2 is for $19.4 million in maintenance at five schools in Fairbanks, North Pole, and Two Rivers, including new boilers, insulation, windows, lighting, plumbing, and other upgrades. Free says the work continues a longstanding district approach to maintenance.
Our schools in general are in very good shape, but the reason they are is because we've made some wise investments in them over time.
Free notes that the Fairbanks North Star Borough has the second lowest bonded indebtedness per capita of any organized area of the state, crediting a long-term maintenance plan, Hajdukovic says, spreads out work at schools across the district.
And even if your school is not on here, it probably has been before or will be in the future as far as upgrades.
The second bond package is eligible for 70% state reimbursement and would add $14 to an annual property tax bill on a $200,000 house. The Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce Board has passed a resolution in support of the school bond packages. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The municipality of Anchorage has rejected a referendum petition that was aimed at stopping the city from collecting union dues directly from employee paychecks. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The application was rejected for two reasons. One is procedural. The main sponsor modified the application at the counter after sponsors had signed it, crossing out a section and handwriting something else in. But even if that wouldn't have happened, Deputy Municipal Attorney Dee Ennis says the application would have been rejected anyway, because the method of collection of dues is an administrative issue, not a larger policy issue.
This initiative is about whether or not dues should be collected by payroll deduction. That is just too small a matter to put on a ballot. The larger policy issue here is what's called the right to work, and that is whether employees have the right to decide for themselves whether or not to join a union or pay dues to get a job. The question for these sponsors is whether they want to change the initiative to place a larger policy question on the ballot.
Michael Chambers is the vice chair of the Alaska Libertarian Party and a spokesperson for the Anchorage Tea Party. He signed on to the application for the referendum and says the group plans to revise their application.
If the city is rejecting it only because it's too narrow, then I would suggest that we should have some recourse in that regard to find out exactly how broad the measure needs to be.
The municipality employs about 3,000 workers. About 2,000 hold union positions and are required to pay union dues. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Alaska Supreme Court is scheduled to hear an appeal of a Healy area natural gas license. The High Court will consider the appeal filed by the Denali Citizens Council tomorrow. It's the latest volley in a long-running dispute between the local group and the State Department of Natural Resources over licensing Usabelli Coal to look for and potentially develop gas in an area around Denali National Park. A license was first applied for in 2003. A state best interest finding in favor of the license was issued in 2010. DCC board member Nancy Bale has been involved in the public comment process.
And although it was a tough decision for a small organization like DCC, where we had to go out to our members and ask them for donations, we felt the arguments were sound and we needed to give this whole issue a public airing up to the highest litigation level.
The final best interest finding granted Usabelli the right to explore for shallow gas on more than 208,000 acres on both sides of the Parks Highway and Nenana River. The Denali Citizens Council's appeal claims the state-defined area improperly includes sensitive residential and wildlife areas and does not provide adequate mitigation measures. Bale says the appeal is not aimed at stopping gas development, which is seen as a cleaner burning energy alternative. The High Court is not expecting expected to issue a ruling until next year. Minnesotan resident Bob Wahlhaber has just accomplished what many Alaskans said wasn't possible. He paddled a canoe 5,000 miles in 5 months alone through Alaska. He left the Washington coast in March and arrived in Westchester Lagoon in Anchorage on Sunday.
I've done a lot of canoeing, but it was all short trips here and there, or part of trapping or fishing adventures or camping. But I always had this urge when I'm canoeing that when I see a point, I like to go around the point and see what's beyond it. I've always loved doing that. It's always been exciting. And as people from Minnesota know that who've canoed with me, they tend to get home late that night because I tend to keep going. But yeah, so I did a 300-mile trip in Minnesota 2 years ago on the historic Voyageurs route, which is part of the French trapping historical route that opened up the U.S. and Canada back in the 1600s. So I did 300 miles on that, and I got done with that, and I thought, I got to try something longer. That was too short.
Something longer is kind of an understatement when you compare 300 miles to 5,000. Give us just a recap of where you started and where you ended.
Okay, yeah, I started in Orcas Island, Washington, which is not too far from Bellingham. Came up the Inside Passage to Skagway, and then I crossed over the Chilkoot Trail, over the Chilkoot Pass, into Lake Bennett, down the upper Yukon River, I call it, down to Fort Yukon, and then up the Chandelier River to where it disappears to a trickle. And then from there, I portaged over through the bush, over to the Koyukuk River drainage system, visited my old cabin site, and then down to Koyukuk, back to the Yukon River, to the Bering Sea, and then I went south along the Bering Sea coastline about 900 miles to the Kwajalein River, up the Kwajalein River to Lake Iliamna, and then over to Cook Inlet, back to Anchorage.
You must have done something to prepare. You mentioned a 300-mile canoe trip a couple of years ago, but what did you do to prepare for this trip?
I only dreamed up the and got serious about this about a year ago. So it was kind of a mad scramble to find the right equipment to try to do all these different parts of this trip that were all uniquely different, trying to find the same gear that would work for multiple areas. So I did a lot of research on that, found a great canoe called the Kruger Sea Wind, which is made for a very seaworthy boat, which was important on this one, built really tough, heavy but tough. And then when I got the canoe built, I did about 600 miles of practice in Minnesota last summer before freeze up, and then I was kind of stuck waiting for the spring.
Did you have times you were by yourself? Did you have times that you were afraid that maybe you weren't going to make it, or did things happen that put you in extreme danger at times where maybe it was kind of touch and go as to your survival?
Yeah, there was some moments on the Bering Sea, the Kwajalein River, and Cook Inlet just 3 days ago where things were really difficult. I did capsize 4 times in the canoe, and each capsize always has a chance of coming out bad, but every time I was able to get back in and continue. There was a few times where I was stuck upside down in the canoe with some real difficult thoughts going through my head, but I got free from the canoe and got out and kept on going.
Are there places along the route that you'll remember as your favorites?
I really enjoyed the Inside Passage, partially because it was probably the beginning of the trip, and I had a lot of pent-up ambitions, and just being able to prove myself against the ocean, that was one of my unknowns, was how was I going to be able to handle the ocean in a canoe. So once I got going on that and I found out it was no problem, it was a good feeling. And the scenery on the Inside Passage is spectacular, as a lot of people know.
Well, I probably should have started with this question, but why?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. I don't have an answer for that one. I just wanted to go on a long canoe trip, and I enjoy exploring, seeing new country. And I did want to get back to the Koyukuk River, where I have a cabin I built back in 1989 as a youth. I went up there and did a solo live off the land trapping adventure of my own for 3.5 or 4 months. So part of it was I always wanted to get back to Alaska and see what became of that.
No one else has done what you've just accomplished. Does your family, you're going home to a family wedding, does your family realize the celebrity status that you've achieved, by the way, without hardly any notice at all?
I don't know if they fully understand. I think my family probably does more than most of the people down in the lower 48, because they don't know what Alaska's like and how quick things can turn bad. The Alaskans that I've talked to, they understand and can appreciate what I went through to do this in 1 year. Many of the Alaskans that I talked to before the trip were the most critical of my trip. A lot of them said it wasn't possible.
And you showed them that it was possible.
Yeah, with a little bit of pride, I feel good that I did it.
Well, you are a classically modest Midwesterner, but this is an amazing accomplishment. Do you plan to do some public speaking about it? Are you putting together maybe a program to show to schools? Have you thought about that?
Public speaking is not really my thing, and I didn't want to. Beforehand, I was nothing about, you know, writing a book or making any money off of this thing. It was strictly my own adventure, and whether or not it might change, maybe there's so many people that are putting pressure on me to know more stories and more detail what actually happened and how I did it, that who knows, maybe something will come out of it.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming in. It's an amazing story, an amazing trip. It's really nice to have you in the studio.
Yep, thank you.
Bob Valhaber is a Minnesota resident who just completed a 5,000-mile canoe trip through Alaska in 5 months. Pictures of his adventure are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.